But I wanted to start by saying something about what it meant to me to be a part of Bob's Lab. I was the last person to join, and I was also my graduate advisor's last student, and I spent the last 4 years of my graduate program by myself, which was sort of lonely. It has its obvious advantages that you don't have to wait in line for the HPLC, but gossiping about yourself is a little boring. And so when I was looking for a postdoc, I asked everybody I knew, who would you postdoc with if you could find a postdoc? And a lot of names came up, but the one name that came up with every single person I talked to was Bob Denno. And I never met anybody who had, maybe this is a bad idea to talk about this at the beginning of the talk, but I never met anybody who had anything bad to say about Bob. And that I think is just legacy, that he was well liked by everybody. And okay, I'm gonna stop with that. But so today I'm gonna tell you about some work that Bob and I have been doing on salt marshes. And this is part of, today I'm gonna be showing you data from Tuckerton, but the people who funded it were the National Park Service, so I could be doing this in Cape Hatteras. And what Cape Hatteras was interested in finding out and what we were funded to do is figure out how salt marshes are being affected by nutrient regimes. So salt marshes, those that are not being destroyed actively through developments of golf courses, housing developments, and agriculture, are being drastically altered by these same activities through nutrient inputs and resources that are flowing into the salt marshes. And these resources that are flowing into the salt marshes, such as nitrogen, are directly affecting the primary productivity of these marshes and then also the consumers that live in these salt marshes, such as the arthropods. And I've been studying with Bob and also with Gina Wimp, we've been studying what happens when you put inputs of nutrients into Spartina alterniflora. So we're all familiar with the salt marsh, but I thought I should introduce a few key characters since I'm the first salt marsh talk today. Our favorite people and small bugs. First, we have groups of herbivores, and these divide up into different feeding guilds. So there's plant hoppers, katydids, and murids. I'm just using these as general examples. So plant hoppers are phloem feeders, katydids are examples of chewers in the system, and murids are examples of cell content feeders in the system. Then we also have drizzly creatures here, detritivores. Columbal aren't really detritivores. They're feeding on fungi associated with the detritus. And then, as Gina will show you later, amphipods aren't really detritivores either. They're more associated with algae, probably. But in dental lab, for historical purposes, I'm going to call them detritivores today. And then lastly, we have our favorite, most jazzy characters, the predators. The jazziest of all is Pardosa, the hunting spider, one of the hunting spiders in the system. And it feeds on pretty much everything. And then we also have examples of web-building spiders, Graminota and Dictyna, which are both the predators but also interguild prey for Pardosa. Well, here's an example of the classic trophic cascade, where as you alter the number of trophic levels, you get impacts on the amount of biomass that you find in that system. And when you have just a predator such as, when you have just a predator, it decreases the number of herbivores in the system and therefore releases the plants so that they can grow. But if you add a top predator such as Pardosa, it effectively controls the other predators in the system, thereby releasing the herbivores. But what's interesting about this system is what's happening at the plant level affects the behavior of the top predator. And this is what I mean by that. When you look at the marsh, you can see areas where there's simple vegetation structure where you can see straight down to the marsh surface and you can see all the muck at the bottom. There's not very much thatch there. But there are also places on the marsh where there's a lot of thatch, and we call this complex vegetation structure. When you have simple vegetation structure, if this is my basic food web with the top predator, Pardosa, and two of the web-building spiders, all of these will feed on the detritivores and the herbivores in the system. And when you have simple vegetation structure, what happens, though, is it's very easy for Pardosa to find the other predators in the system, and it prefers these prey, and therefore is sort of ignoring the detritivores and herbivores and allowing them to escape predator controls. And then by feeding on these two at the level of the predators, then they also are, their effects on the lower trophic levels is lessened as well. Whereas when you have complex vegetation structure, all of these, the Pardosa isn't feeding as much on these other predators, and all of them are able to more focus their efforts on the lower trophic levels and control their population densities more effectively. So then when we add vegetation complexity to the system, we get a combination of sorts of the top predators in the system with the predators and a more effective control of the herbivores in the system. But what was interesting to Bob and I and Gina is what role resources have in this system. So when you add resources to a system, We all know that herbivores are traditionally nitrogen limited. So when you add nitrogen to a system, this may increase plant quality such that herbivores are able to outbreak and escape predator controls. But it also may be that when you add nitrogen to a system, you get more plant growth, more biomass, and that in fact turns into vegetation complexity in following years when it turns into thatch. And that affects the behavior of the system, of the predators in the system, and actually strengthens top-down controls. So by adding resources, we can have one of two options, Bob and I and Gina were thinking, was that you could have a situation where you're dampening trophic cascades by allowing herbivores to outbreak on high-quality plants, or by increasing vegetation complexity, you may be strengthening the role of top predators in the system and therefore strengthening the trophic cascades in the system. How these resources are introduced into the system then is hugely important. And we were focusing on nutrient pulses or nutrient presses. A nutrient pulse is a short-term increase in a resource that's normally limiting, whereas a nutrient press, we were thinking of it as a long-term increase in a resource that's limiting, or a resource that enters the system repeatedly. And we based this research on a project that Claudio had done a few years before, looking at a nutrient pulse. So our predictions then that I'll get to later were based on Claudio's work. Our two objectives were to differentiate between the effects of a nutrient press and a nutrient pulse on the trophic structure of an arthropod community, and secondly, to investigate whether the effects of a nutrient pulse vary from year to year. This is a picture of the marsh down in Cape Hatteras. The data I'll show you today is actually from Tuckerton's, because that's our favorite field site, of course. But this is a nice aerial view, so it allows me to show you the treatments that we've imposed. In 2005, we set up three different treatments. We have a control plot here where we didn't manipulate the plants at all. We had a pulse plot where we fertilized just for 2005. And then we had a press plot, which has been fertilized every year since, so for four field seasons. Then in 2006 and 2007, we added additional pulse plots so that we could see what happened when we compared this pulse to pulses in previous years. And each of these pulses was only fertilized in the year that it was initiated. Our hypothesis then for the plants was that nutrient subsidies would have a significant effect on Spartina biomass, nitrogen content, and vegetation structure. And what I'm showing you here for live biomass and percent nitrogen is if we hold the control plants constant, there's obviously going to be variation in what's happening with the control plants, but if I just take them as a constant, the pulse plants, based on Claudio's work, we expected them to increase in biomass and percent nitrogen in the first year when the pulse was initiated, but then to decrease back to normal biomass and percent nitrogen levels by the third year of the experiment. The press was a little bit more, we expected them to increase for a while. We didn't know how long, but at some point, plants can't get any bigger, so we figured there should be an asymptote there. For vegetation structure, for thatch, we expected them, the thatch in the plots to also increase, but we needed to wait till these plants died, so we expected this to be a little bit more delayed. And then we also were going to look at how the pulses differed from year to year. These are our observed responses for live biomass and for vegetation structure. And what you can see is that both the pulse and the press increased in the first year. The pulse went back down to normal by the third year, and then the press stayed a little bit more elevated. And then for thatch, it's a little bit more difficult to tell here, but it was a delayed response. What I'm going to show you here then is the predicted responses on the left and the observed response here on the right. And to make it look more like the predicted response so we can pair these graphs, I'm going to hold the control constant and show the pulse and the press in relation to what was happening in the control plots. So this is what you see. You can see the pulse is exactly as we expected. The press went down a little bit in the third year, but then is now increasing in biomass. And you'll see that the third year happened to be an outbreak of plant hoppers. And so I think that that's what's happening here. For vegetation structure, it was a delayed response as we expected, and both of them increased. The pulses are back to normal in vegetation structure by the fourth year, and the press plots, they're headed back towards normal. These are some of the plots, and you can see that they're much taller. It's not, so we have more tillers, and we also have taller plants. And then we've been devacking these monthly from May through October for the last 4 years. And here I'm showing my collaborator, Gina. Our first research objective for the insects then was to differentiate between the effects of the press and the pulse on the trophic structure of the arthropod community. Our hypothesis was that nutrient subsidies would alter the trophic structure of the Spartina arthropod community. Our predictions were that for herbivores, the pulse plots should mimic what was going on with the pulse, or for both the pulse and the press, they should both mimic what was happening with the plants and live biomass and percent nitrogen. We figured that herbivores should be tracking the plants. And the detritivores, we thought, should be tracking the detritus in the system. So these two graphs are exactly the same as the live biomass and thatch plots that I showed you earlier. For web-building spiders, we thought that they should also be tracking herbivores in the system. And then hunting spiders, we predicted, based on Claudio's work, would increase significantly in the first year, but then crash in the second year or go back to normal levels sooner than the herbivores. And then for hunting spiders, we didn't really know what to expect, so we just kind of drew this as a straight line, that they could either go out of control, have huge numbers of spiders, or we may see fluctuating dynamics. We weren't quite sure what to expect there. Here are the observed responses. So for the herbivores, you can see that they increased in both the pulse and the press plots in the first year, and then this is the huge outbreak we had in the third year. And then for detritivores, we also saw an increase in detritivores in the first year, which we weren't quite expecting. And as I said earlier, some of the detritivores, which I'm counting as detritivores here, were probably more likely algivores, and algae was increasing probably in response to our nitrogen addition. So I think this is actually a response of algivores here. And then for the web-building spiders, we saw that they increased in the first year, and then in the press plots, they are hugely abundant here in comparison to the pulse and the control. And then in hunting spiders, they also, as predicted, went up. But then, kind of interestingly, the press plots are also had a decrease in hunting spiders. But I think it's easier to look at this in relation to our predicted responses. So again, what I'm going to do here is hold the control constant and show you what's happening in the pulse and the press in comparison to that. And so here we can see then that the pulse went up as expected, but then sort of oddly, we're finding an increase in the herbivores in the fourth year and also in the press in the fourth year. And then for the detritivores, it looked exactly as we expected until year three, and then year four here, we're seeing some interesting responses. About a week before Bob died, we were talking about what to do this summer, and I was thinking, well, you know, the responses look really good up until year three, you know, why don't we just call it quits? And Bob was like, no, something jazzy. Something really jazzy will happen in the fourth year. This will be great. We have to do this. And now I'm kind of wishing Bob were still here to help me figure out what exactly this all means. But for the web-building spiders, you can see that they are hugely abundant in the fourth year. But this I can explain. This is, I think, because of plant height. For some of them, I think they just have more room to build their webs. And then for hunting spiders, they decreased in the third year. And then I was not expecting this in the pulse, that they would go up in the fourth year. And so I'm really happy that all the marsh experts are here. And afterwards, I'd like to have, you know, a discussion with all of you about what you all think this might mean. So another way of looking at this, though, is changes in trophic structure. And what I'm going to show you here are the predator-prey ratio for these plots, and I'm going to hold the control constant. So we're not going to look at variation. I'm just going to hold the control constant at the one-to-one ratio. So if the pulse and the press are doing what the control is doing, they should fall out on this one-to-one line. And what we can see then is that for the pulse and the press, the predator-prey ratio is nearly almost twice as high in these two plots compared to that of the predator-prey ratio in the control plots. And then for the pulse treatments over time, they started to decrease, but then the predator-prey ratio is still elevated compared to the control, even into the fourth year of the experiment. And we weren't really expecting this. We expected them to go back to normal sooner than that. But for the press plots, those predators are just going crazy. They love it. And so we're finding lots and lots of Pardosa and other predators in those plots still into the fourth year. Our second objective then was to investigate whether the effects of the nutrient pulse varied from year to year. And what I'm showing you here is the individuals per meter square for herbivores and then here for detritivores. And green is the control and orange is the pulse. And for each of these pulses, pulse 1, 2, and 3, I'm showing the first year of data for that pulse. So these are not in the same year. So pulse 1, this is data from 2005. This is data from 2006. And in pulse 3, this is data from 2007 to see how these pulses varied, but in their first year. And what you can see then is that in general, herbivores had a positive response to fertilization, except here in the second year, in the second pulse, in its first year, there was no response to fertilization by these herbivores. And then for detritivores, they had a highly significant response to fertilization only in the first pulse. In the second pulse, there was no significant response, and in the third pulse, although it's not significant, the detritivores actually had a negative response to fertilization. And then for web building and hunting spiders, in general, the response is always positive to fertilization in the first year, but it differs significantly in magnitude. So you can see here for the first year of pulse number one, there were a huge number of hunting spiders. And although I saw a positive response of hunting spiders to pulses number two and three, it wasn't as significant. So now I'm going to show you these data, but for all 4 years that I have for some of these pulses in comparison to the predicted response. So for the first year, the observed response for herbivores is always positive. And you can't see pulse number one. It's the exact same as this red line here as pulse number two, but they were both positive responses. But then for detritivores, pulse number three is hidden behind pulse number two here. Neither of them had a response. Detritivores did not have a response to fertilization in the first year of either of those pulses. For all three pulses, I have a second year of data. And so for herbivores, they all decreased in numbers in the second year of the pulse. Whereas detritivores, one of them stayed the same, one actually decreased in numbers. And then in the third pulse, the second year, I had an outbreak of detritivores. And then for the third year, I only have two pulses that have made it that far. You can see that for the herbivores, they continue to decrease. But then for the detritivores, both of them are increasing in the third year. And then for pulse number one, I have 4 years of data, and it's continuing in the direction it was going before. For web-building spiders, again, there was always a positive response to fertilization in the first year. But then in the second year, one pulse number three, continued to have an increase in the number of spiders for web-building spiders, but then a decrease in web-building spiders for pulses number one and two. For hunting spiders, they always show the same response, but it obviously differs in magnitude until the third year when one pulse increased in hunting spiders. I'm not quite sure yet if this is significant. And then for the fourth year, again, I only have that for one pulse. So to summarize then, what we found then is that nutrient subsidies are altering the trophic structure of the arthropod community by changing the relative abundances of the various feeding groups. And that the response of these arthropods to the press treatment and the response to the pulse treatment differs generally in magnitude, but not direction. However, for nutrient pulses, these pulses have elicited inconsistent responses from the various feeding groups from year to year. And the magnitude, direction, and duration of the response depends on the year in which the pulse was initiated. Okay, so that's, I'll turn the floor now to Peyton. No, I'm just kidding. I just have one really quick slide on Peyton. So we've repeated this entire experiment in upland grass, which is Spartina patens. And I just want to show you this because I thought it was really cool, and all the marsh geeks here I think might be interested in this. So for the control plots, this is what Spartina patens looks like if you haven't done anything to it. We put out seven blocks, and in one of our blocks, the press plot after 4 years is thriving. And you can see it's nice and green and really pretty. But the other six blocks, our press plots after fertilization for 4 years look like this. And this isn't fertilizer burn. I mean, anyone who's worked in the marsh knows what fertilizer burn looks like, but this isn't fertilizer burn. These are actually dead plants. And so what happened is these plots have all thatched themselves to death. They all grew so much in the first year that they started to die back. And now if you clear away that thatch, you can see little tiny tillers trying to get through, but they can't make it because there's just this huge amount of thatch there. And so I think it's kind of interesting that this is the upland grass. This is probably the one that would be more likely to have nutrient inputs from golf courses and agriculture. Oops. And this plant cannot deal with this kind of fertilization for long periods of time. And so Gina has a student right now who's counting these plots for us. But it's pretty easy to count the herbivores, I would think, in this plot in year four. So that data should go pretty fast. And so these are the acknowledgments for all the people who have helped us and the funding from the National Park Service and the Ecological Society of America. Thanks.